supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Drug overdoses, mostly involving opioids, killed more than 1,200 people in Philadelphia last year. City officials hope that launching the country's first supervised injection facility will save lives. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports that without the support of top state officials, the controversial proposal is more vulnerable to a federal crackdown.
Opening a site where people can legally inject drugs under the eye of trained clinicians has the support of the mayor, the district attorney, and Philadelphia health officials. Studies have shown that in countries that have tried it, the supervised injection facility results in fewer overdoses and helps get more people into treatment. But Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro and Governor Tom Wolf, both Democrats, are not supporting the idea. They say it would run afoul of federal law. Leo Beletsky is a lawyer and drug policy expert at Northeastern University.
I think that the legal concerns, frankly, are a smokescreen for something that they see as politically unexpedient.
Beletsky says one possible avenue to put the site out of the reach of the feds, having state officials act administratively, basically creating a new statewide rule approving the practice. He outlined this strategy in a paper a decade ago.
I'm so depressed that we're still talking about this issue 10 years on.
98 supervised injection sites, also called safe consumption facilities, have opened around the world. None have opened in the U.S., though there have been some underground efforts. Beletsky thinks one reason the attorney general and governor in Pennsylvania are not willing to get on board is fear of losing law and order voters who may be skeptical of the government sanctioning a place for people to use an illegal narcotic. But he says
the federal statute was never intended to apply to something like this. Safe consumption facilities are not crack houses.
A spokeswoman for Philadelphia's U.S. attorney says the office is studying the issue and will release their position soon. But the former top federal prosecutor in the city once derided the idea of a safe injection site here as, quote, a self-suicide site. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
Democrats are accusing their Republican counterparts on Capitol Hill of giving the Trump administration a pass when it comes to congressional oversight. And WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports that some Republicans for our region think they have a point.
Republicans control both chambers of Congress, which means they wield the gavels and are able to control hearing schedules and the witness list. Those are vital tools for exercising oversight and pressing for answers from the Trump administration. While most in the GOP contend they're doing their duty, Democrats, like Philadelphia Congressman Brendan Boyle, literally laugh off those claims.
I laugh because there has been little to no oversight of this administration. You have some Republican chairs who have acted like they're almost parts of this administration, and oversight is the last thing that they're interested in.
That's why many Democrats and a small but growing number of Republicans are calling for legislation to insulate Special Counsel Robert Mueller from being fired by President Trump for his ongoing investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. At least one bill cleared committee in the Senate. Boyle says that legislation could actually insulate Trump from his worst instincts and prevent him from getting rid of the special counsel.
And in my view, that's an impeachable offense because it would be obstructing a criminal investigation into this a president and to a number of his associates. I am concerned that the president may do that. He's certainly someone who has exhibited incredibly erratic decision-making.
Republicans are growing frustrated with a Mueller probe. South Jersey GOP Congressman Tom MacArthur says he wants Trump to let the investigation run its course. But he thinks bills to insulate the special counsel are all about politics and unnecessary.
Every indication I've gotten is that he's almost done. So I think this is somebody trying to make a point as opposed to actually get something done. Before this bill ever made it through even the House, much less the House and Senate, he's going to be done with his work.
At this point, more than a year in, MacArthur is also a tad annoyed with the investigation's pace.
I think it's taking longer than it should at this point. I do think that. And it's gone off in a number of different directions, although I think they're trying to keep it focused. It's time to let him get it done.
As for the broader criticism that the GOP is giving Trump and his administration a pass, MacArthur says the so-called Trump resistance inside and outside of Congress is bad for the nation.
I think there are some people that are crying out for more and more investigations because they're trying to make this president unable to do his job, and that's not healthy for the country.
Central New Jersey Republican Congressman Leonard Lance says he could support one of the proposals to protect the special counsel, but he says he hasn't fully studied it, in part because GOP leaders oppose them, so no votes are expected anytime soon, if ever. But Lance bemoans the tit-for-tat on Twitter and cable news between the president and the former FBI director, James Comey.
Mr. Mueller should continue his investigation, and I support his investigation. Regarding the back and forth between Donald Trump and James Comey, I find it unattractive on both sides.
Democrats also accuse GOP leaders of giving the administration a pass when it comes to things like the president having foreign dignitaries and lobbyists stay at a Trump hotel just down the street from the White House. Experts say that could break the Constitution's Emoluments Clause that prohibits any president from profiting off foreign governments. Still, Lance says those cases are best handled by the courts, not Congress.
There are cases now in the judiciary, and I have great confidence in the judiciary. And I think that issue is likely to go to the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court has never ruled on that issue.
Then there's the oversight of cabinet secretaries. At least three of them have been accused of spending lavishly on their offices and taking first-class travel instead of flying coach. Lance and retiring Pennsylvania Republican Congressman Ryan Costello recently grilled the EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt over accusations that his agency doled out huge bonuses to his top advisors, put a more than $40,000 private phone booth in his office, and got a sweetheart deal on housing from a D.C. lobbyist. Other administration officials haven't gotten similar questioning from the GOP. Costello says that makes sense.
So some of this stuff, you really got to go through it with a fine-tooth comb. Sometimes the headlines can be misleading, but Pruitt's of a different ilk on some of this stuff. There's no question about it.
Republican Congressman Charlie Dent of Lehigh Valley, who is retiring soon, says his party is being a tad hypocritical when it comes to oversight, especially on all the allegations swirling about lavish spending from members of the president's cabinet. While he doesn't defend it, he points out that Democrats have also been guilty of this in the past.
Clearly, had Shubin on the other foot, you know, we'd be waving a bloody shirt, and there'd be hearings. So, unfortunately, what I've noticed with both parties over the years is that each side, you know, kind of abides by this notion of separation of parties and a lot less separation of powers.
Whether it's the Russia probe or reports of lavish spending by cabinet secretaries, Democrats have no plans to let up on their calls for stout oversight heading into November's midterm elections. And a part of their pitch is becoming, put us in power so we can hold the administration accountable. For WHYY News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
While the Super Bowl win in February will not be forgotten anytime soon, the Eagles' victory is now a permanent part of the city's landscape. A mural celebrating the Philadelphia Eagles' championship win has been painted in Northeast Philadelphia. Details from WHYY's Peter Crimmins.
E-A-G-L-E-S, Eagles!
Spikes Trophies, an awards supply store on Grant Avenue near the Northeast Philadelphia Airport, is wrapped in sports. The eastern wall of the building is covered with a painted collage of the city's athletic champions, going back more than 100 years. The building's owner is Keith Baldwin, and he says that mural, finished in 2014 by Dave McShane with Mural Arts Philadelphia, turned the tide for city sports.
I was kidding Dave the other day that he can take credit for the Philadelphia championships with Villanova starting and the Super Bowl. It didn't happen until he put the mural up on the side of the building. And now hopefully the Sixers we're going to add.
The addition of a new panel showing this year's Super Bowl win extends the mural to the opposite side of the building. It is the first Super Bowl win mural in the city, but it's not the first Eagles mural. There's a much larger one across town near Lincoln Financial Field, and there is arguably a more popular one painted against the side of an artist studio on Bainbridge Street in South Philadelphia. It depicts an eagle capturing Tom Brady in its talons. Its vengeful attitude against the Patriot quarterback has made it a social media favorite. This mural in the Northeast is more heroic than confrontational. It depicts key moments of the game, including touchdown passes, and a diagram of the Philly special. a risky play that was key to a spectacular victory.
The memory of that, for an Eagles fan, will always be crystalline.
This is Hall of Fame sportscaster Ray Dittinger.
I think everybody will remember where they were, who they were with, how they felt when that game ended. But it's nice to have tangible touchstone for somebody that wasn't there, that you can kind of walk them back to it and say, yeah, this is what it was. You know, that's Nick Foles and that's Brandon Graham, and kind of walk them through the whole history.
Next to the Super Bowl panel is about 100 feet of blank wall waiting for the next championship. Dittinger says the next panel might be the 76ers, but he's not holding his breath. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
The Philadelphia Parking Authority is that part of city government everyone loves to hate. Philadelphia drivers know that sinking feeling, coming back to your car and seeing that blue and white envelope on the windshield. But in other places, parking citations are handled in a more stealthy manner. At a recent first-person arts story slam for WHYY's Common Space, Teresa Nutter shared her experience.
I'm going to give you the setting. September 2008. Kutztown, Pennsylvania, Kutztown University. It's a rainy day, I just got a new job, and I parked my car without a parking pass. It felt good, and it felt dangerous, but I did it. I go to class, I come back to my car, no ticket. So I do it again the following week, and then the week after that, and the entire semester, and nothing happened. At this point, I think I'm basically a god. But then my car breaks down and I don't have a car anymore. But at this point, I now live on campus, so it's not a problem. About 4 years later, it's my senior year now. I'm in Spanish class. I'm only in this class because I need it to graduate. But so this professor knows this. She understands that the only reason why I'm there is because I need this class to graduate. And I'm really only looking to get a C. And, like, she just hates when I'm in her class because she knows that I'm only going to do, like, the basic requirement, which I do. And then one day, I'm doing, you know, hola, como está, bien, all that. And out of the corner of the door where the window is, I feel like someone's watching me. And I look, and there's a gentleman in a white polo shirt, and he has a walkie-talkie on. And then the gentleman behind him is a Kutztown University police officer. And then the gentleman behind him is a Kutztown Township police officer. I don't think anything of it, or I ignore it. I don't know exactly what happened. But then they knock on the door. And they ask to speak to Senora Shine, and Senora Shine goes out. She comes back in. She just stares at me. Senorita Nutter, these gentlemen would like to speak with you. So I get up and I go out. It is the gentleman in the polo shirt is the constable of the district of Berks County. He says, Teresa, are you aware that you have a warrant out for your arrest? I am now. Shouldn't have said that. He said, are you also aware that I have been searching for you for 3 months? No. Shouldn't have said that either. And he said, are you also aware that I am permitted to arrest you right now? And I said, for real? Shouldn't have said that either. And he's like, oh, we got ourselves a comedian here. I'm like, well, funny story about that. Yeah, I am. And so he, like, dead serious. He just looks at me. He's like, I need you to get your ID and tell me if you have any weapons on you right now. And I said, well, sir, knowledge is my weapon. Shouldn't have said that either. And, like, all three of these cops are just, like, fuming. And they know, because, like, I'm not being rude. I'm being snarky. And I'm not being disrespectful, but I'm being snarky. And also, it's college, and I'm in Spanish class. Like, what can I possibly do? So I go and I get my ID and I get all of my stuff. And at this point, all my classmates are just staring at me. So I actually get arrested. They put handcuffs on me. I get taken into the back of a police car, and I get driven to Fleetwood, Pennsylvania, which is about 15 minutes away. And I have to see a closed circuit judge because the judge isn't there. And she goes, for real? You know you have to pay $600 because you decided not to get a $50 pass? And I said, I thought I was God. Thank you very much.
That's Teresa Nutter, recorded for Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. You can hear it at 8 in the evening on the last Sunday of each month on WHYY-FM or via podcast. Philadelphia is ground zero for flamenco, thanks to the efforts of the group Pasión y Arte. In advance of a performance tomorrow evening, joining me now is the group's founder, executive and artistic director, and choreographer, Elva Eva-Ivaca. Elva, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into an explanation of how your efforts diverge from standard flamenco, define flamenco.
Oh, flamenco is a wonderful, amazing art form that was born out of oppression, very much like jazz and blues, and it solidified in the south of Spain after the Reconquista of the King Ferdinand and Isabella. They took over after 800 years of Arab rule. Numerous, you know, cultures lived cohesively together.
So how long ago?
1400s.
Are there known records of flamenco dating back that far?
Flamenco as we know it, with the guitar, cante, which is song and dance, is not till the 1800s. But the cante, the verse, the song, can be dated back into the 1600s because of, you know, the Arab tradition, the oral tradition of the Arabs and the Sufi and the poetry was very much alive.
And it certainly traveled west. You're from La Paz, Bolivia, where you were inundated in this flamenco culture starting at the young age of 5.
It was, yes. I went to a conservatory school, which colonialized conservatory school, which is really celebrated the Spanish culture. And so Spanish classical dance was what I was introduced to as age 5. So there's various different styles of Spanish classical. Ballet with soft shoes and castanets and that sort of thing. Flamenco came into my life at 13.
And Elva, let's note that yours is an all-female group, although many would consider flamenco to be patriarchal in nature.
Well, it is, because at this moment the gypsies hold the torch, and gypsy culture is very patriarchal, and therefore the culture of flamenco is still very patriarchal in the gypsy world. Women were not allowed to do very much at home in terms of going out or having friends. But when they went to the performance, they had their husband. They are usually the guitarist or singer. That's the only way they could be allowed to dance. And for the first time, they could actually rule. You know, everybody had to follow. But after that, they went home and they were in a very different environment.
So it was just in that space and time. And so describe tomorrow's performance.
Well, tomorrow is very unique, and I'm very grateful for Intercultural Journeys and Ligwe Foundation to be presenting this 12 by 12 by 12. 12 by 12 is really a one-woman show that I'm doing. I'm going to be showing my work for 12 minutes, involving the audience for another 12 minutes, and then having discussion for 12 minutes.
The clock will be of no consequence on this coming and subsequent First Fridays when your group embarks on Juergas.
We're excited. I'm really excited about our First Friday jam sessions. It's inclusive of any genre, any musician, any dancer. So we go into this very particular space in the studio and we find a commonality. And our commonality is usually rhythm.
Now some 17 plus years on, how has your organization evolved?
Well, it's very exciting, and I started off knowing that I needed to make work that was about women for women and that had a narrative, and flamenco traditionally does not have a narrative, and I was just interested in making that narrative, and that was my intention, to make work that was about women for women by all women, and it's evolved more and more into the experimental work I'm interested in, my new relationship to flamenco as a 59-year-old woman versus a 30-year-old woman. It's interesting, scary. I feel like it's evolved in a very organic way, and I like what I'm doing now.
Looking back, was there ever an alternate career path, or you knew as a young girl that this would be your calling?
I knew since I was 3 years old that I wanted to dance.
Who introduced you to it?
My grandmother. I lived with her. And I had such an amazing woman to show me the way to art, nature, respect for myself. And I think that light carried me through because I had a very tumultuous childhood, and thank goodness I had that in my dance to keep me from going crazy.
And obviously you continue to honor her each and every day and year.
I do. She lived to 102 and was right there.
Did she dance?
She danced quite a bit.
Until what age?
I saw her dance till she was 100.
Thanks so much for spending time with us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you so very much.
I've been speaking with Eva Heavy Ivaca, founder, artistic director, choreographer, and executive director of the group Pasión y Arte, in
Gracias.
Performance tomorrow night. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. Newsworks Tonight.